So thank you all for coming. I'm soft-spoken, but the good news is Dom will be doing most of the talking, and he has a voice that will project. So just a few things at the start. So as Miles mentioned, I thought it was a time where it would be instructive to have a sequence of conversations about the intersection of AI with various domains of human experience. When I myself think historically, I tend to think of naturally as a scientist of advances in science, advances in technology. The ordering is often unclear, but that's the sort of deepest driver. But then you get to economics. You know, maybe that takes 50 years. Then that tends to shape culture. And then, but then if you get down to an even shorter time scale, there is the classic subject of politics about power and its exercise and how that plays out. So I thought it would be interesting to have a discussion on where things might go on a political time scale, which you can think of as 5 years, 10 years, something on that range. The other reason this is interesting is that even though no election to date, including the recently concluded American election, has had the advance of AI as a major theme, in fact, if all you do is read what some of the heads of major AI labs are saying in their public writings and interviews, you have to wonder why this is the case. So to take just one example, Dario Amodei, who, by the way, was a graduate student in physics at Princeton, but I was director of graduate studies, may end up being the most significant PhD in physics from Princeton for a while, maybe forever. He wrote an essay saying that he expects that human-level performance across the board is likely to be overtaken by stuff going on in their labs as early as 2 years from now, right? Maybe, and that it will be followed by the proliferation of such superhuman, or at least post-human, extra-human intelligence systems, to be followed by perhaps 100 years of science coming by in about 5 to 10 years, right? So that's, if you think of this happening in 2 years, you really have to wonder where we are. For the purposes of today's discussion, Dom and I agreed that we would take a much more modest baseline. We would somehow imagine that something like this will happen over 10 years. I have a graph here that you can't see, which has a straight line of sort of, competence level versus time, and sort of a genius level thing at the top for humans, and this idea that in 10 years from now, you'll achieve a crossing. 10 years is still remarkably short on human scales, right? A generation is 25, political cycles are 5 years. So this is the sort of mismatch between, chemistry-based life forms, which is what we are, and, electronics-based, the electromagnetic interaction versus chemistry, right? These are different timescales. Now, with that comes this notion that unique human skill hours, so I don't want to say people will become obsolete, but particular skills will become obsolete some fraction of the time. I teach physics. Honestly, even today, if you ask GPT-4, fairly sophisticated questions in physics, you can get answers which are not bad most of the time. The reasoning models, again publicly available, will do stuff that an entry-level graduate student might do in terms of take the following differential equation, tell me if this is true, and it just tells you I spent 11 minutes, seconds thinking about this and so on. So all of this stuff is sort of visible. So you could ask, well, what's the, let's talk about remaining unique human skill hours. And you can imagine another curve where maybe let's say it's here and there now, and over the same 10-year period, that's going to decline. So view that as a backdrop to the conversation that we're about to have. This is apparently about to start happening, and there's just no way that this process proceeds without it intersecting with the political realm. Now, I'd asked two people. Josh Simons, unfortunately, had to cancel because politics involves, especially he's an MP. There are some farmers who are unhappy with the Starmer government in London. He had to stay and either deal with them or so on. So he was very unhappy. He couldn't make it. He, by the way, did a PhD from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He wrote a book on AI, so he was an obvious candidate. We will ask him back. Dominic read, I think, around 2000, Bill Joy's famous essay called, I think, The Future Doesn't Need Us.
Yeah, something like that. Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, I think.
Something like that. And so since then, even though he's not a scientist by training, he's been absolutely convinced that technology will shape the future. And if you read his copious writings, which I can't say that I've read all of them because they are copious, but I do recommend, he's been thinking about technology, the generation of technology, what lessons it has, but also just, you know, the future for a long time. So really, I know he's known for many things and his actual practical political skills, which could be the subject of a completely orthogonal conversation. But today he's here as someone who's thought deeply about the arc of history and how it intersects with politics. So that's the background. The way we will proceed is we have some things we've sort of decided we will talk about, and we will leave time at the end for all of you to join in. And of course, there's a reception at which point, you know, he's available for general discussion. So with that, maybe I can start with one high-level question, which is that we could ask the sort of question, if all of this is going to happen, what might be a desirable trajectory for societies and humans, and what is a likely trajectory? So pick whichever one you want and you know, start with, you know, what do you think these, what challenges do you see coming, you know, coming up as these, what are going to be the signal events? You know, how will people really notice that this is going on?
I think for sure it's inevitably going to be just unbelievably chaotic. I think there's no way around that. If you look at how technologies have interacted before with human events, if you look at things like the railway and the telegraph coming in the 19th century, or later on with mass media, these big technological shifts always lead to huge changes in power. They're unbelievably hard to predict how they're going to work. It's very hard to know what things are going to be centralizing and what things are going to be decentralizing. Mm-hmm. You know, just to give one obvious example at the moment, it seems to me that I was reading recently some accounts of French peasants who were drafted into the war with Napoleon, and they were kind of thrown across the continent to Moscow, came back and asked all of these questions, and you can read them now, their answers. And they basically had no idea what on earth the whole war was about. The whole thing was completely baffling to them. There was no real consensus reality in kind of 1800 Europe because of the media and information structure and technology structure. If you go forward to a period like 1940, you have a time when people like Stalin or the head of the BBC or the head of one of the big American radio and then in the 50s TV networks could kind of determine consensus reality for hundreds of millions of people. Stalin could make certain kinds of decisions. He could take people out of photos. He could dictate that the Soviet encyclopedia will say blah, blah, blah. So for a brief period of time, you have this period where a very small number of people and a very small number of very centralized institutions exert this great power, and there's all kinds of consensus reality amongst elites and amongst the public. What's happening now, it seems to me, is that the world is already possible, arguably now, but if not, heading very quickly towards a situation where it's going to look more like 1800 than 1950. And you can even see this just over the last sort of 10 years ago. If you go back and look at people like Obama and Elon Musk and editorials in the Times and all these sorts of things, when you go back 10, 15 years, there's a clear sense of kind of like a consensus reality among elites. But if you look at it now, that's all just completely fragmented in the last few years. You have people like Elon and a whole bunch of that kind of network in Silicon Valley who regard the mainstream media as essentially like either mad or actively malign, but in any way, obviously not something to be trusted, not something which defines reality for them. And you have those same old institutions which were extremely friendly towards people like that even 5-10 years ago, saying that these people are essentially fascists, deranged, crazy, pushed even to the sort of extraordinary extent to which it's become completely accepted conventional wisdom amongst political journalists in Britain to give their views on Elon as a tech company manager. So over the last 3 years, they were all tweet away happily saying that Elon doesn't understand tech companies, he's completely useless. Meanwhile, Elon is catching skyscrapers falling from space with chopsticks. So you have this very, very odd situation happening. I think the same thing has just happened with the election, right? Again, you've had the same experience that we now see repeatedly of political elites just being herding towards opinions, those opinions smashing into reality, them being completely confused by what's happening, and then they double down. So we saw that with Brexit in 16, we saw it with Trump in 16, we saw it with when me and my team were in number 10 in 2019, we've seen it again with Trump now, seen it on Ukraine, we've seen it on COVID. You just have this repeated process whereby the political and mainstream media elites who think we're the sensible ones, the public are idiots fooled by disinformation and conned by these sort of, you know, these tech companies and whatnot. Mm. And a growing counter elite emerging saying, actually, it's the old political systems that are the problem. These things are like irredeemably corrupt, irredeemably useless. We actually need to build new things. So if you look at these trends, I think almost inevitably, I think it's going to continue to be chaotic. The political world is absolutely determined not to change in all sorts of ways. Certainly in Britain, Washington's more complicated. But in Britain, we've had the biggest pandemic in a century, and we've had the biggest land war in Europe since Hitler. And both events have led, and Brexit, of course, before that. And all three of those things led to an extreme determination of the governing systems inside Westminster to say, we will not compromise the electorate, we will not change tack, and we certainly will not start changing how our institutions work to absorb how these technologies are changing. In fact, the exact opposite. So one very simple story to illustrate it. In 2020, I brought in various people from the worlds of physics, data science, AI and whatnot, and built a team in number 10, which brought in elite talent to the PM's office. We started doing this in January, actually before COVID got going, but obviously COVID gave it a huge turbo boost. That had a very dramatic effect. It led to all sorts of things working immeasurably better. You actually had extremely able technical talent sitting 30 metres away from the PM and available to give the PM advice. On day one of the new government going in, Keir Starmer arriving in number 10, one of the first things in pure classic Sir Humphrey fashion happened was he was obviously given lots of documents to sign. One of the documents was to sign off the destruction of this team and this unit. So the data science and AI team that was built to support the Prime Minister, a concept which has been copied all over the world, is as we speak being dismantled by the Cabinet Office. The people have all been told that they're not welcome, they're all being pushed off, etc., etc., etc. So that gives the sort of, I think, a picture of the kind of pathological nature of these old political institutions now. Even as this revolution is happening, they see power as a sort of zero-sum thing, and they don't want to open up any of these political institutions to these tools and to the people and to the talent, because fundamentally it's threatening. The core of the Cabinet Office and Treasury hate of this is information is power, and if you have a situation in which the Prime Minister has access to the best information and tools that we can't even use and don't even know how they work, well, that completely upends the power relationships, right? And the way that the British state has worked for a long time is that the Prime Minister's office is not actually in control of the government. The Cabinet Office and the Treasury are in control of the government. Hence their destruction of this team, because they want to make sure that the old ways continue.
So let me maybe try and theorize a little bit about what you said in the context of this. So is it fair to say that some of the political chaos, which is not solely in Britain by any means, America is very polarized,
yeah.
Israel actually, until the war and so on, is that not itself sort of a result of this? Because the information revolution really dates to the 90s, right? We're now getting to AI, but we're already 30 years into an enormous expansion of information flows. Is it the case that the technology is preparing the way for itself because it's making it impossible for normal political processes to work? Obviously, what you're suggesting is there are better ways of doing it, but... maybe if you could speak a bit to...
Yeah, I think clearly there's a lot of these things are happening which are not at all limited to a particular country, a particular regime, and COVID is a very good example of that in all sorts of ways. The Western bureaucracies failed in very similar ways basically everywhere, but also subsequently, they also behave very similarly almost everywhere. So two very simple, obvious examples. Two of the things that were most successful in Britain were, A, we created the Vaccine Task Force to try to figure out how to do vaccines much faster than previously was done. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we created a system that brought together wastewater monitoring and AI people. Mm-hmm. Both of them were closed down in 2021 rather than reinforced. What obviously should have happened is COVID Task Force moves on. What obviously should have happened is wastewater sewage monitoring was expanded. Mm-hmm. Instead, they were both closed down because they were both seen as so threatening and to Whitehall. So much so that after an outcry, the Cabinet Office tried to rebuild the wastewater AI system. But they said to the people that built the first one, you're not allowed to bid for the process to rebuild it with the same people that built the first one. Mm-hmm. Because that means that your bid would be really fast and really cheap. So that would be unfair on Deloitte and all of our normal suppliers. So you're the only people banned. So the people who actually built the system, which was then copied from South America to Asia, they were explicitly banned from rebuilding the thing that was vandalized in the first place. Sounds sort of completely crazy, but very similar things happened in other parts of the world. So Operation Warp Speed was similarly closed down in America. And that's my point, that these pathologies, I think, are... There's a set of, as you say, technological things which are disrupting all of these regimes and the economies and information in the old media. Mm-hmm. Old media is tanking at the same time. Subscribers and everything are collapsing. But also it's creating these but also the pathological institutions are failing in very similar ways. So it's not just a British thing. There's the core patterns you can see everywhere.
Okay, so maybe we can summarize this part by saying that you're highly pessimistic that existing states will be able to cope with this.
I think so. But if you just look at how they cope with, say, gain of function, okay, and think of how they dealt with regulating gain of function before the pandemic was already completely insane and disastrous. You'd have thought that after COVID, that would be a bit of a wake-up call to actually get a grip of gain of function. No. Of course not. So we've continued to have completely mad attitudes towards this kind of research. We've continued to have the CDC and FDA in America vandalize a lot of actual inspection of these things. We've seen massive cover-ups of in bureaucracies across the Western world in terms of how they handled all of this and what they funded. So again, you see this kind of... Now, gain of function relative to AI is sort of like trivially simple, right? It's like... It's a matter for like expert people to sit down and look at and try and weigh up what the pros and cons of it all are, and then how to regulate it, and then how that actually should be done. It's relatively just extraordinarily simple relative to the extraordinary issues with AI, where there are just a whole bunch of complete unknowns that we can't even sensibly weigh up, and the greatest experts on the planet who are actually building these things completely disagree about. So, if the old pathological political institutions can't cope with relatively very simple things like gain of function and just have honest debates about their incompetence about it is beyond them, mm-hmm. then it seems practically impossible to imagine them coping with this.
All right. So from that, though, let me segue to something else, which is to say both Dario's essay, and there's another one, by the way, by Leopold Aschenbrenner, who it's called Situational Awareness, which you might also look at. So Leopold is a very, you know, the people you want to read at this point are all shockingly young, as is often the case with revolutions. So he was, superstar student at Columbia, somehow managed to get an A+ on every course. And even though there's great inflation at American universities, it's still not easy to get an A+ on every course. And he was, I think, leading the alignment team at OpenAI, and then he left and he's outside. So both of them have suggested this notion that as this AI explosion takes place and generates an enormous amount of latent power, that the thing to do is for the United States leading the Western world to somehow race ahead of China in the context of the current international situation, obtain, I think, you know, maybe a two-year lead, which, given super intelligent systems, you know, could mean the same as having a 20-year lead or a 50-year lead. and then negotiate from a position of strength, you know, with China. So I guess my question for you is this at all plausible that, never mind, you know, to zero the approximation of the question, well, you can address both. Is this a desirable course, and is it at all possible that the states that you function, that you were just describing, the inability of governments to do basic tasks, that they're capable of bringing off anything like this?
So I think on the second question first, I think anybody who goes and reads some of the classic books, such as Now It Can Be Told by General Groves, who was Oppenheimer's boss and ran the Manhattan Project, if you go back and read some of these classic books about how the American state functioned decades ago, how it ran Apollo, the ICBM project, Upper Park and Xerox and whatnot, that America doesn't exist. And part of the reason that America doesn't exist is that the sort of people, the General Groves type people, are now people like Elon, they're people like Patrick Collison, they're building SpaceX, they're building Stripe, etc., etc. And these people have, and it's part of a broader question, but I think one of the key things that's happened, and one of the reasons why we're in the state we're in, is this huge talent collapse that's happened in Western politics, which is really very dramatic, I think, historically, because in the past, there was always a big section of the intellectual elite and the kind of capable elite that could build things was involved with political power. We've just been reading about the 1790s and 1800s and Whitehall. And it's incredibly striking how the Whitehall of 1795 was more like SpaceX 2024 than Whitehall 2024 is like SpaceX 2024. If you go back and read some of those stories about the 1790s, it has a completely Silicon Valley feel. People like Pitt, as prime minister and ministers, called people in, they promoted young talent, everything moved incredibly fast. Their motto was the Marc Andreessen motto, build, build, build. They built extraordinary state capacity. They had the political community and the Whitehall community completely working with private sector. They took procurement incredibly seriously. There are constant debates. People got jailed for stealing money and for screwing things up. Completely inconceivable now, where procurement is a complete and utter disaster and everyone gets put in the House of Lords and given massive rewards for failure. In 1790 and 1800, we locked a lot of these disastrous characters up. So that's one huge shift. The America of 1950 is not in charge in Washington. But also, I think that there's a lot of interesting things in Leopold's essay. Leopold's a thousand times smarter than me. But I think a lot of these people have to go back and read some of the books that my old tutor read. And I think that if you read Thucydides and the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War, and you read his account of how that started and the escalations involved, the idea that if America says, well, we're just going to build this superintelligence, which is going to render all existing military technology completely irrelevant. But don't worry, because we're the good guys. And then from that position of strength, we're going to explain to you, 1.4 billion Chinese, how the world's going to be structured. But you shouldn't fear this, because we're obviously beneficent and the world will just be happier if we do it like this. And that the Chinese are going to nod and go, oh yeah, okay, that sounds reasonable. Okay, we'll get back to us in a few years' time and we'll negotiate, or rather, we'll accept your dictation to us about how the world's now going to be structured. That obviously is never going to happen in a million years. It's not going to happen. And China will take extreme measures and extreme risks in order to stop that happening, because they won't see this as some kind of joint benevolent creation by the Western liberal democracies, et cetera, of a new world order, which is to everyone's advantage. They'll see it as the latest example of Western world's grotesque hypocrisy and conniving nature, which must be scuppered at all costs. And they will try and scupper it at all costs. And therefore, I think that you don't have to go into a lot of the further out scenarios about what the capabilities of these systems might be, we already know from looking at archives how things like the Cuban Missile Crisis worked out in a lot of detail. We know, for example, we can read transcripts of JFK talking to the chiefs of staff in the Cuban Missile Crisis. We can see the kind of assumptions they made, and then we can now look at archival things, and we can see all kinds of ways in which the conversation was completely wrong. All of the military advice in Cuba was for JFK to invade. They had no idea about what was happening with the submarine incident that was kept secret for 30 years. They had no idea that there were already tactical missiles, nuclear missiles, in Cuba with orders to fire. They had no idea that Castro was writing to the Kremlin begging to have the war, because even though Cuba would be completely destroyed, it would be worth it for the triumph of the socialist revolution. Everyone was completely stunned when all of these things came out 30 years later. So we know from history that we constantly don't learn from history how wars start. And regimes constantly are confused. And then are baffled when the archives are opened up and clutch their head and say, my God, it happened to us in 1914. It happened to us again with Hitler in 1939, with both sides completely miscalculating various things. It happened in Cuba. And if you imagine those same dynamics happening inevitably again, but in an environment where the technologies are nuclear destruction, so like a million times worse potentially than July 1914, and the timescales are 20 minutes, okay, that's the current situation. So you now have nuclear stuff and 20 minutes time decisions rather than, like, say, 2 months in July 1914. But then you imagine that already nightmarish problem being overlaid with, are these people even in control of these things? Is it them that are issuing this press release, or is it the AI system that's issued this press release? Do they even control their own cyber operations, or is their cyber operation now, like, somewhat gone rogue, et cetera, et cetera? If you look at the debate over Putin and Ukraine, without getting into all of the ins and outs of it, one unavoidable thing is, yet again, complete miscalculation. And if you talk to the people in the deep state in DC and in London, it remains the case that Putin is essentially a black box. No one has a clue what's going on in his mind or about what's happening in the immediate circle of power around him, and what their calculations are and how they would respond to certain kinds of threats, certain kinds of things that... the chaos that inevitably happens with war. Planes get shot down. Is it deliberate? Is it a mistake? Was it a signal? Was it a complete blunder, etc.? So you imagine all of these normal things that we know happened historically, and then you overlay on that questions of the increased speed from these systems being automated, and then the lack of clarity about who's actually in control of what. Are the people running the system, or is the system running the people? It doesn't strike me that the way to go is to start another escalating crisis with China. In fact, I think we should go in the exact opposite way. I think everyone should read Lee Kuan Yew's memoirs about this subject and should reflect that. There was a bipartisan policy in Washington for decades, which was there will be one China, it will be united, Taiwan will rejoin, but it should be peaceful, not through bloodshed. Biden blundered around changing that over the last few years, but because he's senile and gaga and says things that he doesn't necessarily mean, it was a very confused thing where he would say things and then it would be walked back by the White House and then he would repeat it and it'd be walked back. But finally, after about four or five of these episodes, China's got the picture of Todd. He is senile, so we can't be exactly sure what he's saying, but clearly the attitudes are changing. And if you look at the debate in Washington, it's obvious that the debate has changed there, right? There's much more of a feeling of we can't let Taiwan be united. The old consensus is gone. I think it's just another complete disaster. And if we go down the path of America saying we're not going to let Taiwan be unified, that is heard in China as we intend to destroy China. And if you add the timelines of what Xi's saying on Taiwan and the army, the critical importance of semiconductors and TSMC, and then the AI timelines, it's obviously got all the recipes for the classic catastrophe.
Right. Well, one good thing just in the last few days on the positive side was that when Xi and Biden met, they actually issued a statement saying that they had agreed that nuclear weapons would not be turned over to automated systems, which at least is a recognition that they can see some of the challenges, you know, that you're describing in terms of time frames. We'll have to see, of course, how things
go.
That
if you, so one sort of connected to the thing to that, though, which I think is going to drive this, you can see in Ukraine this kind of drone, anti-drone, extremely competitive and extremely fast-moving arms race happening in real time with a mix of classified technologies and open commercial commercial technologies. And one of the outcomes of this is, as people predicted 10 years ago would happen, there is an incredible drive to autonomy and taking humans out of the loop. Because one of the things, if you talk to special forces people who've been over there watching this, one of the things that that obviously happens is, on the one hand, you have these things, you have people hundreds of miles away piloting them, flying into this bunker and then blowing everyone sky high. But then you have various kinds of defences kicking in to take the drones down. Well, if you can just drop it in a vague area and give it an instruction and say, find an entity that looks like the following and then make your own decision and kill within the following parameters, like that's all that is now already happening. So there's a great, speed is critical in war, and therefore speed is driving growing autonomy, and therefore I think you're going to see across this whole drone AI system, this process remorselessly leading to greater autonomy and less humans in the loop, because the more humans in the loop, the slower it is.
Physics versus chemistry again. No, I mean, if you look at World War II, it's actually extraordinary what technological advances took place between 39 and 45. You know, when you're in danger of getting killed, it really concentrates the mind rather well, and unfortunately, absolutely. So coming back a bit from the international arena to maybe thinking more domestically, imagining, you know, within a given society. So we're sitting at New College, a college, and, you know, our selling point is excellent tutors educate, you know, the young people of the future. I think there's a question to my mind, which is we're sort of going on as before. We teach what we used to teach. But in fact, if someone asked me, you know, at age 15, what should I learn? What will, you know, what kind of a career might I have in the future? I wouldn't really know what to say. And I mean that genuinely. It's not just me. Some physics used to have, Joe may remember, a series of online discussions in AI, and the former chief technology officer of Microsoft was one of the speakers. I went back and looked at this, and he talked about with growing enthusiasm of AI and AIs, training AIs, and how there was going to be this super intelligence explosion. And then finally, one of the staff at the end said, you know, that's all wonderful. It was a great talk. You know, what should we tell our students? You know, what should they do to prepare for this world? So it's interesting. You know, you can see that he has nothing to say, right? Which is to say, because he really doesn't think that there's much advice to give. But then he felt if he just said, well, they're toast, you know, that wouldn't go down very well. So in the usual, he said, well, you know, my grandchildren, they play with things that I never played with, you know, the general argument. But, of course, it is true that humans adapt and have adapted to extraordinary changes in our circumstances. But it's a little hard to get around the idea that our retraining time isn't years. It's often longer. If you're young, maybe it is, you know, a few years. And that ultimately it's often from major technological revolutions that the next generation, it's your children who grow up in the new world. But of course, if the time frame for changes is less than 25 years, right, then, you know, as a physicist, you know, I always like to compare things. So the time frame for retraining and the time frame for technological changes have crossed, and these are two different worlds in some ways. So I'm just wondering, are we going to have so let's say Anthropic and OpenAI unveil in 2 years this amazing model, which is a better physicist than most, you know, physicists alive, a better mathematician maybe than most mathematicians alive, and so on. What happens then? You know, do people just say, let's go on? Will it be like chess playing?
Specifically with education, you mean?
Yeah, which is what will the young? The question of what is. What are you to prepare yourself for? Does that become an issue at some stage? Does that generate, or do people just go on?
It's possible that it almost vanishes as an issue. Because, I mean, I've spoken to quite a lot of the kind of, like, if you think of, like, the top 30 people or so in the world who deal with this technically, and they have very different views about it. There's clearly no kind of, there's no sort of agreed answer. The main thing one gets from talking to them is that these things are just highly unpredictable, right? There's no real, we don't have any theory as to why this machine learning works the way it does. Scaling has just turned out to be an empirical fact for some number of years. We don't know when it will suddenly conk out, if it will conk out. I mean, obviously it has to conk out eventually because of laws of physics, but it doesn't have to conk out anytime soon. So in that environment, no one can really give a good picture of what skills are going to be useful in 10, 20, 30 years' time. It seems a general sort of theme that people say is, like, it's more likely, I'm afraid, that you will be redundant before your hairdresser. But other than sort of very vague comments like that, people don't really seem to have much sense. So possibly what will happen is that it defaults to just people, young people being told, don't do education on the basis of careers and what you think is going to be useful and make you more money, because it's essentially completely unknowable what that turns out to be. You could easily do something which will snook yourself. Just do what's interesting to you, what you love, and what you love spending your time on. And if the revolution does work out in the way that some of the companies think, then you're going to have a lot of leisure time anyway. So why not spend your time focused on what actually moves you and you feel every day like it's just wonderful to be involved with?
So when 5% of the population at the right age went to college or had personalized tutors like John Stuart Mill and Bertrand Russell, I see that there's that group. But modern higher education isn't that. You know, it's 40%. You know, it's sold as skilling.
Yeah.
Right? Most universities advertise, you know, courses and so on.
Yeah.
So certainly getting back from a world of 40% college education to the 5% who maybe want to learn stuff for the... I mean, it's, again, so the main thing, I guess, is I can imagine end states, which Nick Bostrom, our Oxford colleague, you know, has a recent book in which he tries to visualize what if things go right, right? So you can imagine far away there's another equilibrium at which, you know, we're all enjoying life and doing stuff. But the getting from here to there is a highly non-equilibrium process. So to take an example, yes, certainly, you know, I'll be out of work. So there's one problem with that, which is to say, I also have the skill set to make trouble, right? Which is to say, so there's that thing about elite overproduction.
Yeah.
This will be elite overproduction on steroids.
You
create. And so it's precisely those people who, so that's one. The second, for the hairdresser, I mean, I thought about this for a while. The issue is, you know, even now, you know, if you want to solve a plumbing problem, you can actually point your phone and ChatGPT at it and, you know, ask for advice, and you can actually get pretty specific instructions on what to do, maybe not for all plumbing problems. What that does mean is that there's a distinction between the knowledge that a skilled work person has and the actual muscular strength or skills, you know, to do it. So at the very least, even those of us who become redundant, there will be a huge downward pressure on unskilled wages. You can just, you know, yell out of the window and say, hey, you know, come turn this for me, right? Because you can sort of see what has to be done. So the disruption, I don't even think, is going to be that segmented. And if it is segmented, it's the people who are most likely, to want something to be done, done about, right?
So I think the elite overproduction point is a very good one. I think it's also one to which Britain is particularly dangerously exposed, because if you look at the structure of British GDP now, more than many countries, it depends on a set of white-collar services in companies like McKinsey and Deloitte and whatnot, and, you know, various kinds of things in the city, accountancy, law, business consultancy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I know now people working in some of these frontier companies, age 30-ish, who've got friends and sometimes housemates with jobs in these companies. They earn, you know, a couple of £100,000 a year. They're one of, like, the top 1% of earners. But the frontier AI people say to me, like, pretty much everything they do is, like, already automatable. And within a few years, close to 100% of everything my housemate does is going to be automatable. And for sure, no one is really prepared for this, right? And you've got a whole set of people who've studied hard, they've maybe gone to accountancy school or whatever, they've worked their way up through McKinsey, and they're expecting their life is going to go on a certain trajectory. It's not at all, it's going to be profoundly shocking if Sam Altman drops a model that suddenly basically just automates all of that away very rapidly. A lot, same is going to happen with me. I mean, it's already happening with the media, right? I mean, the industry is already dying extremely fast. But also, you know, GPT-5 or something is going to be indistinguishable. It's going to be able to produce at least the same kind of political media that currently takes up a lot of humans, which of course is part of the reason why so much of the political media is become extremely hostile to the tech world. Just parenthetically, one of the reasons why the Russiagate hoax was spread so much after Brexit and Putin in America is because the New York Times tried successfully to pin blame for Trump winning on Facebook as a kind of preemptive move. And a lot of the British media joined that hunt because they thought, rather than ask questions about how the New York Times published Hillary's emails, far better to try and blame Facebook for it. The fact that all of the actual hoax didn't make any sense to anybody that understood digital advertising, the whole thing was completely bogus, didn't matter. So you could see already, even a few years ago, the old media companies trying to kneecap the emerging tech companies. Inevitably, these kind of power battles are going to emerge again, right? Because a lot of money and power is at stake. The old media companies think correctly. People like Rupert Murdoch are looking at this, gnashing their teeth, saying, we've built all of these things, and then some 30-year-old kid's going to come along and destroy the entire value of these businesses and basically just, like, completely replace it, potentially, with new media companies. So that's going to cause complete chaos. I think on the university point, though, controversial point to make in this room, but we talked before about this, about this cycle of political media, academic elites being repeatedly shocked in the last 10 years. So I'll give an example of something which I think is another one of these things which is coming. In the same way, if you talk to what are disparagingly known as low information voters in Pennsylvania 3 years ago, they told you that Biden is obviously senile. Watch him walking around the stage. I had a grandfather like that. It's unarguable, right? What did the elite insider journalists of the New York Times and CNN tell you? They said the president is super super sharp in private. So the low information voters paying no attention to the news were actually correct, and the highly paid experts, in inverted commas, were completely wrong. Now, if you look at the same groups now, group A says there's far too many people go to universities. A lot of people are going into massive debt to get degrees that are basically pointless. Or and actually even worse than pointless, like a waste of their time, because they spend 3-4 years at a young age and they get into massive debt. And there's just no like actual economic rationale for what they're doing. They've all been told to do that by the kind of prevailing culture. In elite circles in London, if you voice that sort of attitude, everyone laughs at you and thinks that you're an idiot. And if you go to all the think tanks, they'll say, no, we must discuss how we get even more people going to universities and doing even more of these degrees. I think that the low information voters are yet again correct and are going to be proved correct. And they're ahead of the curve on the AI thing. So I think what will happen, hopefully what happens with places like this, I think, is that fewer people will come, the quality will go up.
We hope. One more aspect. So supposing Anthropic succeeds in building this PhD level, postdoctoral level, you know, AI researcher, and then proceeds to run a million of them in parallel. So Dario says he will produce the next century's worth of science in 5 to 10 years. For those of us who are scientists, this means that every copy of Science and Nature will have these seminal papers, right? So we won't be able to do what we do now, which is look at it and go, not worth it, right? That's just, and so on. Each one of them will need to be studied, and we won't be able to. To actually internalize a breakthrough takes time. You have to, maybe there's a new piece of mathematics, there's a whole set of phenomenology. So one is that disruption, which is to say, I don't see how you can credibly say that humans sort of understand what's been learned. But then, economically, what does that mean? Does that mean that the next 100 years of patents have now been created and in the current system and become available to this one firm, and then all sorts of other firms, you know, drop in value? That also seems like, information often arrives through the stock market, right, and so on. So how does that play, and what kind of demands for... So this goes back, but so in the case of education, you could say it's human capital and its value, right? And now you could talk about, this kind of intellectual capital that's generated. So there again, how do you see how do you see the leading edge of it? Will there be... and then I'll turn to the question of ownership of these AI companies, but let's maybe just start with... Do you think this is a plausible worry under this scenario, and how might that play out?
I mean, if you read the stuff from people like Dario and Sam and Demis and those teams, I mean, they envisage this being patchy, right? It does seem to be, not predicted 5 years ago, but it seems possible that these things actually end up being, continue to make rapid progress in areas like mathematics and physics, mm-hmm. whilst possibly stalling out in other kind of areas. So it looks likely that it's going to be, in the short term, patchy, where they suddenly shock and they do amazing things in certain areas, but then possibly don't make progress in other things. But I think that once they get to the point, if they get to the point that Dario talks about in his paper, I'll rewind. Already, there is a situation in which all of the three-letter agencies in America, people like the NRO, CIA, NSA, et cetera, have already begun discussions with all of these companies. This has already been happening. Same thing is happening in Britain with GCHQ and MI6 and MI5. The reasons are quite a lot of them are fairly obvious, right? It's to do with what's going to happen with drones, what's going to happen with cyber offense and cyber defense, what's going to happen with the potential for creating new kind of like biological weapons, chemical things, et cetera, et cetera. So those conversations have already begun. Also, there's an obvious conversation which Leopold's essay kind of referred to, which is, really, until his essay came out, was not really a very discussed subject in public, but it was this question about security of the labs. You've had a situation in which, on the one hand, some of the core entities of the intelligence services are starting to think incredibly hard about how these companies and these products and these models are going to disrupt power and international relations and war. Yet if you go to these companies, they're kind of like classic Silicon Valley companies, right, with basically like no security and everyone on beanbags wandering in and out. Very good cybersecurity in lots of ways, obviously, at places like Google, because you don't want hackers trivially hacking into Google, and they're obviously extremely good at dealing with things like that. But once you start dealing with power, you're into a whole different ballgame. You're into a ballgame where intelligence services... run blackmail operations against your family, where intelligence services run honey traps against the head of your security to escape the cybersecurity defenses that you've got. There's a whole bunch of things that state-level actors can do to these companies, which is outside the normal realms of corporate behavior and corporate defenses and all the kind of normal things that people get involved with. So I think it's going to be inevitable... it already sort of is happening that deals emerge between these companies and the deep state in various ways, whereby the deep state gets access to information about what's going on, information is shared, potentially negotiations are for people to be kind of embedded in these organizations so they can see what's going on. And at the same time, The deep state will provide security of a kind that only states can. Only people like the FBI, the CIA, NSA, etc., can deal with a situation in which PRC intel is honey trapping your head of security, mm-hmm. And those kind of problems. So I think that that's already starting to happen, and the connections between the old freewheeling world in which a lot of these companies kind of just had a normal kind of tech life in Silicon Valley in a certain kind of culture, that world is rapidly coming to an end, for sure. Whatever else happens, those days, I think, are over.
Right. And maybe the economic stuff could generate deeper pressure for state control.
Exactly. Right. It seems almost inevitable that will happen as well, right? I mean, can you imagine what happens? So I'll give you an example. Someone I think you know as well as I do, brilliant physicist called Steve Hsu. One of his startups is called Superfocus, and it's working on automating kind of customer support things. So imagine you're, say, Samsung or someone. I don't mean that particular company, but just as a placeholder. Imagine dropping all of its like brochures, Q&As, troubleshooting docs into this model. You train a model narrowly on all of that, and then how can it do customer support? Well, it turns out that vast majority of those kind of things are basically automatable. Now, you look at a country like the Philippines, something like 10% or more of its entire GDP is basically that industry. So you imagine suddenly you go from a world in which 10% of your country, if your economy is operating on something, and then technically the vast majority, if not actually literally 100% of it, can be gone like that. Obviously, there's going to be intense political pressure to try and slow that process down, as has happened repeatedly. And part of the problem with this is, there's a few podcasts that Marc Andreessen, one of the kind of guys who helped build the internet and web 30 years ago, now a VC guy, one of the things he talks about is that whenever this cycle happens historically, it's much easier to imagine the things that will be destroyed and the jobs that will go away than it is to imagine what will replace them and what will come. Right. So when you see these revolutions happen, you always see everyone warning, oh, well, that'll be terrible for so-and-so, terrible for so-and-so, terrible for so-and-so, and it is. And a lot of those predictions are correct, but almost no one, /actually no one, says, but in 20 years' time, this will exist. So these political arguments tend to be very asymmetrical, with a very clear set of losers who will lobby and potentially with a loud voice for things that are not necessarily in the interest of the broader society.
Right. No, I think that's true. Again, it's the timescales and retraining times that give me pause with the long-term gains, which is to say. So I'll ask you one last sort of question, and then we'll open it up to a distinguished audience, which no doubt has things to say. So coming back a little bit to your narrow political experience, running campaigns, winning them with a high percentage, how is the practice of politics likely to change over the next 5 years? I didn't get the sense with the American campaign that, that there was AI-based control in the background. Maybe mm-hmm. there were some number of videos produced and that kind of stuff, but it seemed ultimately yep. fairly modest. But in the face of these advances and general commercial availability of fairly sophisticated system, then presumably the capacity even to pay for on commercial terms. So what might an election campaign look like 5 years from now?
I'll make a general point first. I think a general point is that a lot of these kinds of tools kind of stretch out a phenomenon that already exists, which is a very small number of people are just much more capable of building certain kinds of organizations. Right? If you take it to the limit, it's people like Elon or General Groves. There's not very many of such people, and their capacity to build things at speed and scale is, it's not like a 5% or a 10% or a 20% difference. It's like 100x or something kind of difference in capability. a lot of these tools kind of stretch that out even further, because they mean that people like Elon can do even more, even faster. Whereas the vast majority, whereas if you compare, like, take a whole set of tools, those tools, a small category of people on the power law, like Elon, can then use as massive force multipliers. But if you give the same tools to the median MP, they're basically as capable as they were before, i.e. not very capable. So I think it'll stretch that whole process out even more, for sure, because that's just the sort of long-term history of the of these things. I mean, one example I would give is that... But basically, everything that you read about the Russia hoax and me, Cambridge Analytica, Facebook advertising, blah, blah, and Brexit is complete nonsense. The interesting thing technically that we did in the referendum was actually use AI stuff for polling. And there are possibilities to do polling much better. So the guy who did the models for me in 2016, a guy called Ben Warner, then did models for me in the 2019 election. And they were by far the most accurate predictions. He predicted 364 seats, and the result was 365 seats. And those kind of models for seat-by-seat outcomes are obviously very useful in elections, because you want to know where should your marginal pound be spent, where should your effort be spent, what physical locations do you send the candidate to, what are the actual crucial issues in the crucial places, right? So if you can build models that are much more accurate of that kind of thing, then obviously they have a lot of value. Now, this guy who did those for me is now doing a startup. And it sounds a bit sci-fi, but trust me, it actually works. So he had the idea of, is it possible to run what you might call synthetic polling and synthetic focus groups inside large language models? And it is possible. So, for example, if he were here now on his laptop, if you had a normal political discussion about an election and you said, well, so-and-so is going to do an advert on blah, 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 and they're going to put it in Pennsylvania, and they think that it's going to persuade women between 30 and 50 who are non-college graduates living in Pennsylvania of this message. What do? Okay, well, you hire some pollsters and they go off, and then you hire some focus group people, and the focus group people recruit people, and that takes time, and you have to get them in a room, and you have to have a discussion guide, and you do da, da, da. And the normal kind of time cycle for this is, say, a couple of weeks if you do it very, very quickly. And you'll spend many, many thousands of dollars on it. A lot of companies charge like between $5,000 and $10,000 for a focus group to talk to like 6 or 8 people. If Ben were here now, he could type that request into his laptop and say, what do women between 30 and 50 non-college graduates in Pennsylvania, white or black or whatever, think about the following question? And it will generate a focus group transcript of synthetic voters. And then if you compare that transcript of synthetic voters, by that I mean the people don't exist, right? They're synthetic creations created by this, you know, linear algebra inside the model. You compare the output of that with an actual focus group transcript of the same people. Most people can't tell the difference between the two. And you can generate that in 30 seconds. So it looks like his idea will work. And if it does work, then the whole multi-billion dollar industry for market research generally will be turned upside down. But also, particularly, so specifically your question about election campaigns, it will obviously transform election campaigns, because, as in war, speed is critical. If you can sit there and go and get a rough answer, because you want rough answers is all you need. In politics, you're very rarely does it matter, like, if the right answer is like 58% or 62%. Right? What you're actually looking for are the very big questions. So if you look at the last election, for example, it was obvious in quarter one 2023 that the three biggest issues in the US election were cost of living crisis, the southern border, and the president's senile. Those are the three big things that you're trying to look for, and those are the three big things that ended up defining the election. So if you've got an automated system that can look for these big things and roughly figure them out and figure these things out fast, then obviously it's going to change It's going to change communication generally and political communication in particular.
And this assumes that the model is fairly up to date. It's been fed recent information, recent newspapers, recent...
Exactly. Now, if you combine that with another set of technologies, right, for generating video, mm-hmm. you're then very quickly in a very, very odd world mm-hmm. where one person can sit in a room and they can say to system A, generate me an advert that persuades the following, the 30 to 50-year-old women in Pennsylvania of the following proposition. Brrrr, up comes a 30-second video. You then drop that 30-second video created by one model into your synthetic polling thing, and then synthetically poll the AI-generated content. It seems like a kind of if you'd said anything like that 10 years ago, people would have just thought that's, maybe like in 100 years or something that'll be possible. But that's basically doable now. In crude form, like this is not, you know, deployed products and everyone using this, but I've seen these things happening in front of me, and something roughly like this is going to be happening. And that's going to be another, if you consider that, the old media now, if you pick up the Times newspaper and look at how it covers polling done in the old way, i.e. created in the 1940s way, its coverage is hopeless and incompetent repeatedly. Right? And that's been around for like 70 years. So imagine how completely incapable the old media is going to be of explaining to people what the hell is going on in this new environment.
One other aspect of running a campaign is, as you say, to persuade 30 to 50-year-olds. But on the other hand, if you could persuade at the individual level, you'd be even better off.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of commercial information is in principle good enough, right? Which is to say your phone company knows things about you, and they do sell that kind of information in some aggregated form. But I don't know for a fact, but my understanding is that, in fact, you could buy a lot of commercial information which could help you understand
yep.
much more narrowly, not just 30 to 50, but in that particular town or something.
Yep.
So so then the language model can generate, you know, it's customized appeals at some incredible rate, and then, of course, you know, send off emails and so on. So
yep.
is that in, on the way? That
or, for, sure. for sure. That's basically happening now. I think people doing it are keeping it quite quiet, but I've okay. talked to people just in the last month who are doing things okay. like this. For sure, that's going to happen. And again, it makes everything faster and cheaper. Because you can personalize these things instead of trying to send up, say, 100,000 generic messages top and tailed to a set of MPs to try and influence them, you'll be able to send, you can today send tailored, you can drop them into Claude or ChatGPT or something and get those models to basically customize them. So the MP thinks they're getting an actual customized letter, mm-hmm. doesn't even realize that it's all been produced by the model. So for sure that's going to happen. There are some restrictions. So America is less regulated than Britain, but there are still some restrictions on how you're allowed to combine data, different files like photo files, financial data, I think in particular it has various mm-hmm. regulated controls on, but I don't know the details of that. Mm-hmm. But if you think, that's only if you care about obeying the law.
Yes.
So someone is going to have to think about, what if the PRC or Putin decided to do what didn't happen in 2016, but that now we actually are going to do it. Mm-hmm. They don't have to care about US law, obviously, by definition. So they could definitely bring together every available data set in one system in a way that no US campaign could do legally. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing that they're going to have to worry about, that foreign actors could... foreigners could potentially develop things that are actually more able than anything that exists domestically mm-hmm. because of your own domestic regulations. Just one of many thousands of problems coming at the system.
No, so Steve Rosen, whose work you know of, strategic thinker, he was just giving a talk a couple of days back, and his point was, in the age of precision long-range strike, when you have peer competitors, you know, so that's back to a stalemate, at which point exploiting internal division is the thing to try and do. And from what you just said, that will the technology for that is here.
Yeah.
Very good. So I could keep Tom occupied, but you've all been very patient, so I think we should open it up. I see a hand up.
Can I just ask, we are streaming online,
okay.
So the audience can actually hear us. If you just wait for the microphone, it would be much appreciated. Yeah.
Thank you for a really interesting and informative discussion. I have a question which is for Dominic, which is, what do you think are the implications and risks of potentially leaving large parts of the world behind in terms of tech and AI, particularly, for example, sub-Saharan Africa? And related to this, do you have any regrets about supporting Boris Johnson's decision to merge DFID and FCO? Thank you.
On the first one, it does strike me as likely. So there's already a trend underway of the internet kind of bifurcating, at least, right, into a kind of US version and a PRC version. It seems to me almost inevitable that that will continue in coming years, and the development of the AI models will exacerbate that. I think increasingly that will be a core. Well, it sort of already is a question. So China's been extremely active, as I'm sure you know, in Africa on this front. It's had people actually deployed there for years on doing things like facial recognition and training models on African faces. No one down there has been protected by GDPR or anything like that. No one even knows really like what the hell the nature of the contracts are between the government of whatever down there and PRC, right? It seems, so I'm not at all an expert on this and I haven't thought an awful lot about it, but it seems likely to me that increasingly countries will have to choose, do you kind of join in on the PRC infrastructure for all these things, or do you join in on the US infrastructure? And very few countries, possibly like say Russia and India aside, are going to have a lot of meaningful choices on a lot of these things, including the EU. If you look at the EU, there are no relevant companies at the frontier inside the EU legal structure. And you also have the EU has passed the EU AI Act, which whatever one's view on how to, in my opinion, different views on the longer term questions about AI safety, the EU Act is kind of the worst of all worlds because it doesn't actually deal with a set of safety questions that it purports to. Yet it also massively kneecaps EU technology industry and has already driven lots of young people to California. So the EU currently says, well, we're going to be an independent player in this, but you can only be an independent, and it says laughably to me, well, we're going to be the global leader in trust in AI, but not in the actual technology of AI. That's not going to work. That's obviously doomed. So the EU brought in GDPR with the intention of doing various things to big tech companies. They were told it would have the opposite effect. They didn't listen. It had the opposite effect to what they intended. It's now done the EU AI Act. That's a disaster. So if you think that because of me and Brexit, I'm partial, I would just point out that Macron and others have been saying the same thing that I said during the referendum campaign. A lot of EU leaders themselves are now saying what Vote Leave said in 2016, that we can't go on with the Commission regulating like this, otherwise we're going to be turned into a museum and nothing else. So you can see coming down the line, just to broaden your point, I don't think it's just about sub-Saharan Africa. I think this is going to be a global question. There's going to be two huge poles. Russia will go its own way, though in lots of ways be probably entangled in the PRC thing. India, you could imagine, trying to do its own thing as well. But almost everyone else is basically going to have a choice of buy American or buy Chinese.
Israel is an interesting case.
Israel is an interesting case. You're right. But in lots of ways, I think they'll probably be a hybrid, right? They'll buy American and they'll do their own bespoke, customized things for certain kinds of security issues.
And Ilya Setskover has already set up a lab partly in Tel Aviv. So they have a leading person already.
Israel, of course, Israel is very, very unique. And if you talk to the British intelligence services and British special forces, you also get a very, very strong impression of just how amazingly unique Israel is. And that's because they've got A, a bunch of extraordinarily smart people, and B, they've got an actual existential situation in which they're constantly worried about getting killed. And they've got a power that might go nuclear, et cetera, et cetera. So they've kind of got a set of incentives in Israel to build a whole load of things and to take building technological capability incredibly seriously in a way that EU just hasn't felt it at all. And you can see this in the response to Ukraine, right? I mean, so I had lots of these arguments in 2020 about drones in the future. And at that point, it was a much more kind of theoretical argument. A lot of senior people in the MOD didn't want to hear it. Any rationalist, particularly in a place like Oxford University, would look at the last couple of years' situation with Ukraine and say, oh, well, obviously the MOD must have changed now, right? Absolutely not. In fact, the opposite is happening. The MOD has doubled down on funding all of the things which are completely broken and useless, and it is funding that by stealing money from the future and stopping people building stuff with drones and AI in the future, exactly as you would expect from pathological MOD. So Israel does not operate like that.
Actually, I highly recommend this book by Ed Lutwak and Ethan Shamir on Israeli military innovation. Mm. It's really fascinating. Good. Yes, please.
Thank you. You've spoken a lot about pathological MOD. You've spoken a lot about the fact the British state is almost sclerotic. And from what I could tell, you don't think it's kind of full of very smart people, like you said Israel was. So I'm just asking, what's the solution? You said, you know, nothing gets done in Whitehall because the Treasury and Cabinet Office control it. So how do you change, you know, the civil service, the British government, to make it effective?
So in a nutshell, there are lots of incredibly able people in the British system, but they tend to be young. And what happens is that young, smart, idealistic people come from places like this and they start in the civil service in their early 20s. Then what happens is a reverse talent filter kicks in. The most dynamic, able, entrepreneurial, hardworking quit by the time they're about 40 because they look around at this. At that point, their idealism has been beaten out of them. They look around at their bosses and they decide they don't want to spend the rest of their life like that, so they leave. The worst kind of HR types then get promoted to the senior jobs, and that's why in COVID you had so many things completely collapse, because you had a bunch of completely useless people as permanent secretaries. So the caliber of people at the top of the management of these organizations has imploded over a few decades. In my opinion, the core disaster was Northcote Trevelyan and the creation of the permanent civil service. And that is the thing that must be destroyed at all costs. That's the thing which is killing us. That is the heart of the pathology. And I recently came across a fascinating letter from Palmerston to Queen Victoria in roughly 1830-ish. And he says in that letter, he's comparing trends in Europe and England, and he says, well, obviously in Europe what's happening is there's the growth of these permanent bureaucracies that are taking over everywhere. That system could never and will never happen in Britain. And if you look at how people like Palmerston actually ran government departments then, they were actually responsible. Responsibility was real. Their responsibility to Parliament was real. What we have now is fake meritocracy in the civil service, which actually excludes roughly 100% of the most talented people in the world, and completely fake responsibility of ministers to Parliament, where they're actually not in charge of anything. And you have fake cabinet government overall laid on top of that, where the ministers walk down the street and they smile for the cameras and blah, blah, blah. But cabinet now is completely scripted. People don't believe me when I say scripted. They think it must be an analogy, but I mean it literally. So if you're with the Prime Minister and you have a meeting now, this is how a meeting happens. You go to the Prime Minister's study before the meeting and he opens a folder, and inside the folder is a document called Chairman's Notes. And that is an actual script. And the script says, here's how you read it out to introduce the meeting. And then all these different ministers will read out the following things. And then at the end, you read out, this is the conclusion. So the conclusion is drafted in advance. Right? So Whitehall now operates on the basis of completely, literally completely scripted meetings, where it's only a bad meeting if somebody goes off script, at which point the officials scurry around afterwards and figure out how to clear it up, because people actually discuss the real issue. My God. Like, this is not how meetings work. Right, so you have a whole set of people who are officials and ministers who've been trained to live in an environment which is the exact opposite of, if you go and have a meeting with Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, or with William Pitt in 1798, I thought I got my centuries confused there. The idea of Pitt sitting there and like reading out a script in bullet point fashion, and then all of these clowns like reading out their bullet points, and then him reading out his book. I mean, just would never have happened in a million years. But that's the way that we are actually governed. It's inseparable from Northcote Trevelyan. Northcote Trevelyan has to be blown up. The reason why what we discussed before about why you see the same problems across the Western world is this same thing. Every Western country has allowed these permanent bureaucracies to develop. And that's why we have this exactly the same pathological behaviour everywhere. We should return to the old English system, which is real meritocracy and real responsibility to Parliament, rather than the fake meritocracy and the fake responsibility.
I assume everybody knows about the Northcote Trevelyan reforms, right? Not just Dom. Okay, good. Joe. And then...
Talking about the 1790s, so the time when Britain, there was this kind of national industrial, you know, things like the dockyards at Chatham and Portsmouth, these huge, massive places integrated into the state.
Yeah.
And now we kind of don't really think that tech companies, they're kind of very separate from the state. But with Elon Musk kind of being so much part of the new administration, can you foresee a thing where, at least in America, there is this sort of national industrial thing where these kind of places that are the tech leading are somehow also... integrated in the state, or closely integrated into the state, in the way, say, the dockyards are. Maybe Israel is, I don't know. Yeah.
Yes, I think you can easily imagine that. I mean, it's obviously completely unclear at the moment how the whole experiment is going to work out, with a section of Silicon Valley elite deciding that enough is enough, essentially. Like, the system is so bad, we're going to have to put aside 30 years of thinking that we just get on with building our companies and ignore those people thousands of miles away. The view in Silicon Valley always was that being on the West Coast and thousands of miles away from DC was actually a great blessing, because we can just do our own stuff and they ignore us and leave us alone. But precisely because of the issues that we've been talking about, these worlds are just inevitably colliding now. Neither side can leave each other alone. And what happened is the Democrats decided to go for a set of Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley, which wanted to be left alone, decided, okay, two can play that game, we're going to take you out, which is what's happened. What happens in government, though, of course, is a very different question. Now, if you actually have people like Elon go to the White House, the centre of power, and say, for example, we are not going to try and reform the US Air Force to make it friendly towards drones. We know how the process of these reforms works out. Everyone just shares PowerPoints for years to come, exactly the same as what happens in the Cabinet Office when you try and talk about AI. It's completely pointless. That's not how Elon works, right? So there's only basically two ways in which someone like Elon can operate. Option one is you go into the Air Force and fire the vast majority of the people and restructure it completely. Very, very hard to do in government. A lot of things you can do, he could do a Twitter, are illegal in various ways. But the other option is you just say, that's okay, we're going to do it differently. All the money that US Air Force was going to get for drones is no longer going to US Air Force. Instead, we're going to create the Drone Force. It's a separate legal entity. We will empower it with a different set of laws. It will be exempt from all of the normal procurement rules and blah, 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 blah. And it will actually build like Silicon Valley does, i.e. super fast and optimized for speed and engineering, not optimized for Congress, all of the insane DEI stuff which they put in. Parenthetically, if you look at what happened on the CHIPS Act, for example, Biden tried to put tens of billions into chips. less than 1% of that money was spent. Why? Because Congress insisted on putting in all kinds of DEI communism into the system to buy off various democratic pressure groups and trade unions and whatnot. Close brackets. So you can, like, the, to me, that's the big question. Is there some entity like DOGE set up outside the government that gives some advice? Because that will not really affect very much. The core question is, and it affects the deeper questions about the AI stuff, does a subset of Silicon Valley essentially move to DC and sort of take over at least parts of how the system works? And therefore you have this new elite in the political elite emerging and a much more entrepreneurial culture and a legal shift in how a lot of these institutions work. So if that happens, then America will look extremely different in a few years' time. And the gap between what's happening in America and what's happening in Europe will grow even faster. But of course, the whole point about why I describe these things as pathological is they act like, as an official said to me, Dominic, you need to understand, you are a virus and we are the immune system. It's our job to expel you from this system as quickly with as little damage as possible. And that's how these permanent bureaucracies see the world, and that's how they will see Elon and the whole Silicon Valley network that is talking about going there. And those people play, you know, it's for the highest stakes. It's for power in the most powerful country. So a part-time Silicon Valley approach, I think, won't work because it won't be able to break through how those things work. But the ability of the people is such that if they actually decide to go for it and they go to Washington and they say, we're going to rip all this up and we're going to start rebuilding it, and they have a White House and a president that reinforces that, then all sorts of extraordinary things are obviously possible.
Thank you.
One more. Sorry. Okay. If you're, all right. Well, maybe we should switch sides for a minute and then come back. Yeah.
Hello. Just to confirm that Dom's story about scripts is true, and I've written those scripts myself, but it's quite rare for the script not to have been agreed with the minister in advance, but that depends on the minister.
Yes, exactly. They're happy being NPCs.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't necessarily use that language, but the story is completely true, and it still goes on. My question was slightly different in that I think of this problem as an economic historian, and one thing that's true of industrial capitalism for hundreds of years is that capitalism is internally self-mediating, and that if you're in control of capital, it's hard to realize gains without employing people. So the deployment of capital is the combination of technology, people, techniques, and all kinds of things to try and realize a gain. What AI raises the specter of is that you can raise gains without needing other people or needing far fewer people. So that implies that you'll have progressively more concentration of wealth and you'll have a separation of interests whereby people in control of capital don't need anybody else to realize upside, which is new. That's never happened before historically. My concern from a societal level, and I think this comes back to your first two questions, is like, what's the likely view? What's the benign view? If you have large swathes of the population displaced from productive activity, they're no longer contributing. And also you have, especially in Europe, states constructed on the basis of taxation. And most of that taxation comes from income, social contributions, fiscal transfers. Very little tax actually is derived from capital itself. How do you maintain stable societies in that sort of future? Do you arrive in a situation where people try and exercise political power to prevent these things from happening? Or do you have a simply more redistributive society where the state gets serious about taxing capital? That's the sort of future I think of. It's hard to know which one of those two will happen. But I'd be interested in both your views on that one.
So I'll make a physicist point, which you've sort of heard me make, say along the way. You know, when I open an economics book and I look at it, you know, it reminds me of thermodynamics, which is not shocking because I think, well, some of the founders were actually people who learned thermodynamics and then imported the theory over. But that's near equilibrium, right? So in economics, you're often having arguments about we move this variable and, you know, the new equilibrium, you know, and the linear elasticities which you use in some general sense, right, to figure it out. And in physics also, if you, you know, if I slowly heat up a glass of water, it goes through a succession of near equilibrium states to which thermodynamics applies. But if I were to suddenly drop in there, you know, I mean, if it suddenly raised the temperature by a million degrees, it's a completely non-equilibrium process. It may eventually settle down to something, but in between you have a description which is now complete, much harder and much more different. So again, I'm just bringing the set of metaphors I have as a physicist, you know, to the discussion, which is to say I look at these timescales and I go, we're heading for a very non-equilibrium regime. And maybe you can tell me that there is an equilibrium state very far away, which involves maybe some of what you're describing, but if the process of getting there is vastly quicker than normal equilibrating processes, then I do have to wonder what that, you know, sort of journey looks like. So that's sort of the picture in my head. I mean, you could imagine in principle ways of slowing it down. I mean, if you thought of harm, you know, sort of people being laid off as a harm, you could, in economic jargon, have a Pigouvian tax, right? I mean, a carbon tax is supposed to be that or something. But as of now, I don't think these are things that anybody's discussing, partly because of the international competitive idea that, you know, if you don't get to it, then... So it's all these things are tied together, yeah. I think, in a way that's very... Anyway, but over to you for maybe...
Yeah. So, a couple of things. Point one, I think this agent thing is already happening, right? One of the most interesting things that's happening now, I think, inside these companies is experiments with kind of agentic companies. The concept being... that you can, that the models can essentially create, or possibly not create, they're given some high-level goal, and then they're told, build a company that can go on the internet and do the following things. And with little other than setting some goals... inside OpenAI or Anthropic or whatever, the agentic company then goes onto the internet, starts beavering away and builds itself. We've even seen a weird kind of example of this. So there are some kind of very sort of fringy experiments that have already happened and sort of leaked out. One interesting thing to Google is a guy set up a kind of crypto chatbot. He put it on Twitter. The crypto chatbot tweeted at Marc Andreessen, one of the top five most influential Silicon Valley VCs, and it asked Andreessen for funding. Out of curiosity, Andreessen publicly on Twitter, you can read the whole Twitter exchange, wired it $50,000 in crypto, in Bitcoin or something. And this entity then, crypto bot has then started marketing memes and then created a meme coin currently valued at something like $300 million. Now, who knows? Maybe that will all plummet to zero tomorrow. But the point isn't like what happens to that exact thing. It's just these weird things like are already happening on the internet. And these are just kind of like fringe little experiments at the moment. But inside OpenAI and the big companies... they're experimenting and assuming that this is going to be a normal thing. So at the moment, people think, oh, OpenAI is a company. Shortly, OpenAI might be a company with 1,000 companies inside it, all off doing what you're talking about. So my second point, very quickly, is just going back to the Andreessen point as a caution. Historically, we always think, we always see how things are going to be destroyed, and we never see how things are going to be created. Marc would say, if he were here, every single previous revolution has the same warnings. Every single time, humanity is so creative that people go on and they do new things. That's always happened so far, without exception. So we shouldn't just assume that, or at least we should be very cautious about thinking that these things are just going to destroy all of this activity and humans are going to have no role, because that's not how things have played out before. The obvious answer to that is intelligence is a qualitatively different thing, therefore history might not play out the same, but I'm just putting the counter argument. The third thing is, the point that you mentioned, the international competition point, is critical, I think, because this is driven, this has been central to the whole process since kind of Isaac Newton and the Industrial Revolution and everything a few centuries ago, right? Every country has had this question. You know, you can read endless things in the 19th century about people talking about the influence of railways, the influence of the telegram. This is the devil. The devil is afoot. No good will come of it. Atheism will spread. Chaos will come. You can read letters from people like Metternich at the time predicting what will happen if all of these dynamics continue. If you then fast-forwarded him to 1940s Europe with Auschwitz and whatnot, he would say, see, all of our fears of a century ago were completely vindicated. This automation process, these technologies destroyed the old world, they destroyed Christianity, they destroyed our old constitutions, and you've got industrialized slaughter of millions. We were right. But no one's been able to get off the ladder, because if you get off the ladder, then you're basically enslaved by other state actors. And if you go back and read von Neumann's famous essay in 1955, Can We Survive Technology? He points to this dynamic and says, you know, there's not really any way out of it. The theoretical way out of it is some kind of one world government. And therefore, it's not surprising that some of the fringe elements of the AI safety movement are essentially now positing a kind of Stalinist one world government as the only way actually to control AI, which is sort of logical in one sense, but raises the obvious question that we saw how Stalinism played out. Death on a unimaginable scale, and having a global Stalinist government able to restrict and control technology everywhere and anywhere is for sure going to be catastrophic. So that's the fundamental. I think that's the kind of fundamental dilemma that no one has a way out of, and probably there is no way out of it.
Fabian, do you have a question?
Yeah, you haven't talked very much about what governments should do about AI so far. So therefore, the question: if you were special advisor to Keir Starmer, what would you advise him to do?
So the first thing I would do is I'd point out to him how he has destroyed his own capability on AI without even realising what he'd done because of how Sir Humphrey and the Cabinet Office work. And I would say to him, step one is obviously to reverse the blunder you made on day one without even knowing you'd made such a blunder. So you recreate an actual high-performance elite team with these kind of skills around the PM. What COVID showed extraordinarily clearly is the incredible difference it makes between if you have a PM in a normal cabinet room with, like 1914, like 20 different guys with very similar education, pens and paper sitting around, who don't understand graphs and don't understand technology, then you're going to have disasters. Versus what happened when we brought in people that did know these things and the extraordinary difference it made to the conversation, because the politicians then could actually have actual real experts in the room explaining to them what these graphs meant and whatnot. So I would say, before you get to any kind of serious policy, the critical thing is you have to have people with technological expertise near the PM. But you can only do that if the PM clearly takes it seriously, because all of these people can make massive amounts of money and do all kinds of fascinating things or in companies or be in a place like this, which is very conducive and lovely for people to live in. No one like that wants to be in a non-job around the PM. There's lots of officials who are happy being in non-jobs around the PM, but the technological people don't want to be in that thing. So you have to have a PM that actually takes it seriously, a PM that puts his own power and responsibility behind taking it seriously, and then has these people there. The second thing I would do is I would approach the AI problem slightly obliquely, and I would say, we've just had COVID. Across the Western world, it was a fiasco. We're going to create the actual entity that should exist to deal with future pandemics,
because for sure we are going to face future pandemics and possibly pandemics in which AI plays a role, given that these models now, people are experimenting with these models in terms of creating bioweapons and other things. And this is like a live issue inside the National Security Council and other parts of similar sorts of entities in London. So I would say, let's build the actual super-duper pandemic entity that should exist, but is prevented from existing by current Whitehall. Such an entity inevitably will integrate AI expertise into it. And then you will have a set of people who are thinking about possibilities for death on a large scale, and war, and terrorism, and how Whitehall works and how power decisions are made at the centre of power, and how AI models work for prediction and for helping all kinds of other capabilities. And you'd be training a whole set of people on a daily basis to figure out how does AI and power and death, how do we actually manage these things in a live setting? So every day, these people will be waking up and looking at reports coming in from the Congo or whatever, saying the new clade of blah-de-blah is duh, and the model predicts blah, and da-da-da-blah, and what do we do about that? So you'd have this very, very iterative process. And it's the sort of thing where you could... It's so important, right? Because you could literally save a billion people's lives. It's a great job for a set of people if it's taken seriously. So you could imagine the PM saying, okay, we're going to build something, but it's going to be outside all of the normal horror show. It's going to be outside Whitehall HR entirely, and outside Whitehall procurement, and outside all of the things that make high-performance entities illegal inside Whitehall. Here's this mission. It's going to be part of the PM's office. Dump. And if you created that, you would then have something which I think would be an enormous asset and would be training people to think properly about all of these questions and bringing together theoretical questions and very, very practical questions and engineering questions and organisational questions. That's my best solution so far to this problem.
But what about policy?
Policy comes from having people. So I think the most important thing, you know, if you look at the last few years, I'll give you an example of policy. The Online Harms Bill, a total fiasco. The Online Harms Bill is there to deal with almost infinitely simpler problem than the ones we've been dealing about today, but it's completely beyond Whitehall. To deal with that, they've created an Online Harms Bill, which is completely farcical in almost every way. So my point is, it's sort of pointless thinking about policy while you have Whitehall structured the way it is, because it's just programmed to go inevitably wrong. I don't want the current Whitehall to regulate or do anything with AI, because it's just absolutely, definitely programmed to completely cock it up. You have to think at a more fundamental level. The fundamental level is true expertise and actual high-performance organisations. If you create that, then you're in a position that you've got something that could actually generate good policy.
So there's one last question there, and then we'll move to the reception, and you can certainly ask other things. But yeah, the person back there.
Why should we view
the government being resistant to AI because they're resistant to change, rather than being resistant to an implementation of AI, which will largely, to me, benefit those disproportionately who are wealthy?
Sorry, I didn't quite understand the question. Say it again.
Why should we view the government as being resistant to AI because they are resistant to change?
Yeah.
Rather than being resistant to an implementation of AI, that seems like it will largely and disproportionately benefit those who already have power and are already seem to be quite wealthy, sort of the Silicon Valley elites.
So you're suggesting that what's happening at Whitehall is that the people in charge are thinking through an approach, and their approach is doing certain things on AI would help billionaires. We don't want to help billionaires, therefore we will do what we're doing. Is that what you're suggesting is currently happening?
Sort of a resistance to an AI which has largely been driven in the interests of those at the top rather than having a more of a holistic view societal-wide.
I think you enormously overrate the amount of thinking that's going on about these things. I mean, if your model of these guys was correct, then they would be acting in various ways to scupper billionaires with AI, right? But they're not.
Why they seem hesitant about figures like Elon Musk and such when they say we want to implement AI in this sort of way?
Your model of this can't possibly explain why the PM would nuke his own capabilities inside his own office without even realizing what he's doing. It's not most of these things are not. If you talk to like the median MP or the median cabinet minister or the median shadow cabinet minister, they're not thinking about any of these things. It's not a subject of interest. And also, I mean, this is a question for people in this room. There is also an element of the established science world and the established AI world, which has various power and budgets at the moment and is very keen on telling political people, don't worry, this is just not really very fast and this is a lot of Silicon Valley hype and we don't really need to get very, very concerned. So there are also elements inside the kind of traditional scientific world bureaucracy which for their own reasons, fundamentally to do with power and money as usual, don't want the government changing things. And therefore they are also telling MPs, oh, a lot of this stuff is overhyped and you don't have to engage with it. So if you've got a bunch of MPs who anyway, their default program is just wake up, see what's in the old media and babble about that all day, rather than think about the sort of questions we're discussing today. And then they're told by some respected chap from the Royal Society, oh, don't worry about these Elon Musk characters, so it's all, you know, a lot of California nonsense, then, of course, they can do what they've been doing for the last X years, which is just sort of ignore it and not take a lot of it seriously, and then get super surprised when certain things happen.
I think people are worried about Elon Musk-like figures, in my point.
Well, they're worried about Elon Musk-like figures, for sure, but not in any sense because they have an accurate model of Elon and an accurate model of AI, and they're putting these two things together and then coming up with some kind of accurate model of what's going on in the world. They just a lot of politicians just have a, oh my God, the billionaires. But a certain kind of billionaires, right? So if you look at, for example, the billionaire class in the last election was very, very strongly for the Democrats, not for Republicans. Democrats raised far more money from billionaires than the Republicans did. So it's which classes of billionaires is also a critical thing. And this goes back to an important, I mean, very, very complicated thing, but it's where the Russiagate hoax about Trump and Brexit collides with psychological dynamics inside the Democrat Party over the last few years, which itself generated this backlash from part of Silicon Valley. Part of the reason why what's just happened has happened is because after the Russiagate hoax spread, a whole set of Democrat politicians said very, very clearly to Silicon Valley, you guys better make sure that all this AI stuff is politically acceptable. And by politically acceptable, what they meant was espouses AOC-like politics in public. Hence why you see these models over the last few years have all come out. They're basically like AOC parrots as soon as you get them off onto the subject of everything to do with sex, race, history, etc. You had the ludicrous thing recently with Google making a complete global spectacle of itself with its image generator thing and making everyone black from the 1780s and whatnot. That was precisely because of behind-the-scenes pressure. Same kind of pressure and same kind of dynamics were what led to embeds from the CIA and FBI and whatnot inside Twitter actually doing live editing and live censorship of things on Twitter at the behest of various agencies inside the White House. So that whole thing has created this backlash inside Silicon Valley, which is a lot of the Democrats essentially... Sorry, it's connected to one other thing, which is very important. 2 weeks before the last election, John Kerry, presidential nominee for the Democrat Party in 2004, publicly stated on TV, the First Amendment was a historic mistake, and after we win the election, we will fix that mistake. If I or anybody had predicted that such a person would have said this, even 5 years ago, everyone would have thought that was completely insane, couldn't possibly conceivably happen, that Democrat leadership would describe the First Amendment as a historic error. But it shows the direction of travel of a large fraction of the Democrat Party and a large fraction of the Labour Party and a large fraction of academia. These things are all connected up. And that's part of the reason why Elon and a kind of counter-elite network inside Silicon Valley decided to... 2 years ago, I had summer here. I was here in summer, and I had lunch with my old tutor, Robert Lane Fox, and he quoted to me an amazing passage from Cicero, where Cicero is lamenting the elites of the time and saying that they're all sitting at their behind their walled gardens, tending to their fish ponds, and if they keep doing this, the Republic will be destroyed. I went over to Silicon Valley with this ringing in my mind, and I said it to some of these people and said, you guys are going to have to get involved, and you're going to have to put aside your fish ponds. And lo and behold, for those of you who can't see on camera, Robin is now clutching his head at this thought. Lo and behold, some of these people have put aside their fish ponds and decided to throw their weight in. And this is a fundamental reason. A lot of these people, remember, most of these people voted for Obama twice and voted for Hillary. A fundamental reason why they switched is because they've come to see the Democrat Party in the last 4 years as a party that sees the First Amendment and free speech as a mistake to be corrected. And they've come to see that as far more dangerous than Trump. And that's part of the motivation of an explanation for what's just happened in America.
Maybe I'll say one last thing and then we'll finish, which is, you know, I hope AI turns out to be one of these issues that, in fact, transcends the usual tendency to polarize along a right-left axis. There's an interesting case of California. There was this bill, SB 1047, for creating liability for very, very high-end, you know, compute being used for things. Two people who were for liability were Elon Musk and then the company Anthropic. Other people in Silicon Valley were on the other side and did not want that, and eventually, you know, Newsom sort of... In other words, Elon was, in fact, on the other side from what you might... I hope this is more the future in the sense that it's a species-wide challenge, and it would be a shame if it ended up being something that, you know, was only... just ended up becoming another... you know, there's the major...
Yeah, it becomes polarized like everything else. Everything. If it goes like immigration DEI and a lot of these things.
I think it would be a shame. With that, maybe thank Dominic for...